KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I'm still comfortable in supporting the president and his policies, hoping that things will even out.
As President Trump wraps up his first 100 days in office, a new poll says 45% of Americans give him a failing grade, but we'll hear from some of his supporters.
For Friday, May 2nd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Elsa Chang. We'll also hear why some Asian Americans are supportive of Trump's immigration policies, even if they emigrated to the U.S. or are the children of immigrants.
They don't see immigration as a racial issue. They see it as a fairness issue or a matter of law and order.
Plus, the search for a universal anti-venom that could protect against poisonous snake bites.
And fans of Lady Gaga are flocking to Brazil to see the biggest concert of her career.
Since I was a little kid, a gay kid, she taught me a lot about loving myself, accepting myself.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. A coalition of organizations in the space community have written to lawmakers asking them to reject the White House's proposed cuts to NASA's science programs. As NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, the administration's preliminary 2026 budget request would eliminate about a quarter of the space agency's budget.
Not every part of NASA would get cut under the White House plan. Human space exploration would see a big increase in spending, like $1 billion in new investments for programs focused on going to Mars. But space science missions would see dramatic reductions. That worries groups like the Planetary Society and the American Astronomical Society. They've written to members of Congress saying this plan would halt the development of nearly all future NASA science missions and require the premature termination of dozens of scientific spacecraft. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
President Trump signed an executive order yesterday telling the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private entity created and funded by Congress, to end federal funding for NPR and PBS, quote, to the maximum extent allowed by law. Trump has accused the organizations of left-wing bias. The order also calls for ending indirect funding to NPR and PBS and prohibits local public radio and TV stations from using taxpayer dollars to support the news organizations. NPR's David Folkenflik has more.
It's not clear he has the power to do this. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting has filed a suit in court that's supposed to, you know, move forward next week. It's being heard on an expedited basis by a federal judge in Washington, and we're going to see. It appears right now that the CPB is simply ignoring the president's edict, saying he doesn't have the authority to do this.
NPR's David Folkenflik. NPR receives about 1% of its funding directly from the federal government and more indirectly, and PBS and its stations get about 15%. The bulk of the funding goes to local stations and subsidizes TV, which is more expensive than radio. The man accused of killing UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson wants the courts to throw out his state murder case. Luigi Mangione has also been indicted by a federal grand jury. NPR's Kristen Wright has more.
Mangione's attorneys argued to the Supreme Court of New York that concurrent federal and state prosecutions violate the double jeopardy clause of the Fifth Amendment. It protects people from being tried for the same crime twice. Federal prosecutors are pursuing the death penalty, and New York state prosecutors are seeking life in prison. They say Mangione shot and killed Brian Thompson outside of a hotel in New York City last December. He's pleaded not guilty in both cases and also faces charges in Pennsylvania, where he was arrested at a McDonald's in Altoona. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Measles cases in the U.S. have surpassed 900 as outbreaks continue across the country. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says 935 cases have been confirmed in 29 states, and in 13% of the cases, the majority of whom are under 19 years old, have resulted in hospitalizations. And among the confirmed cases, more than 90% are either unvaccinated or whose vaccination status isn't known. Measles was declared eliminated from the U.S. in 2000 because of a very effective vaccination program, but those rates have fallen in recent years, leading to more cases. Comedian and actor Ruth Buzzi has died. According to her Facebook page, she died at home in Texas at the age of 88 after battling Alzheimer's disease. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports she was best known for her award-winning appearances on the 60s and 70s NBC variety show Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In'.
Ruth Buzzi's most famous laugh-in character was Gladys Ormsby, an elderly lady with a severe hennet-encased bun and shapeless brown clothes. In one memorable bit, she fawns over John Wayne.
Oh, I wonder what it would be like to be married to a man like John Wayne.
Only to beat him up after her dream comes true. Which causes Buzzy to break character.
Stop! I don't want to do this!
Over her long career, Buzzy appeared in many TV shows, including Sesame Street and The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson.
NPR's Chloe Veltman reporting. And I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This week marked President Trump's first 100 days in office. And according to an NPR PBS News Marist poll released earlier this week, voters have not liked his performance. 45% of Americans polled gave Trump a failing grade. Less than a quarter gave him an A. But we wanted to hear from voters who were among the nearly half of the electorate who did vote for Trump and ask what they've liked or disliked. So our member station reporters reached out to voters in a few different states. Jason Rosenbaum from St. Louis Public Radio kicks us off.
Trump swept the red state of Missouri in 2024, getting over 58% of the vote. And much of that is thanks to Trump's dominating margins in rural Missouri, where voters like Bryant Kagi supported the GOP chief executive.
I don't consider myself a Republican or a Democrat. I can be honest and say I wasn't real thrilled with either choice, but I did vote for Donald Trump.
Kagi says he ended up voting for Trump because, among other things, he's uncomfortable with Democrats on social, fiscal, and environmental issues. But he hasn't been a fan of his first 100 days, largely because of Trump's tariffs. Kagi is a fourth-generation farmer and part owner of a farm that produces beef, corn, soybeans, and wheat. He says he's not sure exactly where his products get shipped to because he sells to a third-party processor in the U.S. who then sells to others. And while Trump's tariffs haven't directly affected his livelihood yet, Kagi expects eventually they'll raise the price of fertilizer, equipment, and chemicals.
Just a government interference into the markets that affect our lives every day.
Kagi says he does have some hope that the backlash over the tariffs could push Republicans to once again embrace free market principles.
You don't want me growing your carrots or your avocados because I'm not in the right spot. I don't know how to do it. I don't have any markets for it. Let somebody else grow the avocados. Let somebody else, you know, manufacture steel. Let somebody else manufacture microchips. Let us do what we do best and let us have open markets that help facilitate me selling the product that I'm best at producing.
While it may take a lot for rural Missouri to cool on Trump, Kagi says free market principles could make a comeback if his policies start affecting people's bottom lines. For NPR News, I'm Jason Rosenbaum in St. Louis.
And I'm Benta Berkland with Colorado Public Radio in Denver. Colorado is a solidly blue state. Democrats control the state government, and Trump lost Colorado in the last three presidential elections, in 2024 by 11 points. But Trump voters, like Susan Virginia, are happy with all the changes in the first 100 days. She's retired, is registered unaffiliated, and lives in Morrison, in the foothills west of Denver.
I'm glad that he's moving quickly to do things, because his first administration He didn't know who he could trust and who he couldn't trust.
She's especially pleased with the informal Department of Government Efficiency and its slashing approach to the federal government.
If you were going to be bankrupt, you would do everything you could to cut the budget. We got to cut the budget. We got to stop paying for things that shouldn't be paid for.
So far, DOGE has fallen far short of its goal to cut $1 trillion from the budget. Virginia is more mixed on Trump's approach to tariffs. She's in favor of them, but thinks they'd get more support if Trump put money in people's pockets by lowering taxes.
And I feel like that should happen now, but my understanding is it's not 100% in his control to do that. It's got to go through Congress.
Susan's husband, Frank Virginia, is a registered Republican who also voted for Trump. Before he retired, he owned a small business.
I'm also okay with the tariffs, but I do have some concerns with the disruption to the markets currently.
The general agreement among economists is that tariffs will increase prices for consumers. Frank Virginia says he's most worried about his investments. As a retired couple, their ability to live largely ebbs and flows with the success of the stock market.
But at this point in the process, I'm still comfortable in supporting the president and his policies, hoping that over the next 4-5 months, things will even out.
His wife, Susan, says she's anxious to see what will happen down the road. She hopes it keeps going in a positive direction. For NPR News, I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
And I'm Ayan Silver with WUWM in Milwaukee. In November, Trump eked out a win in the swing state of Wisconsin by less than a percentage point. It's a place where every vote matters, including in the state's largest county and urban core, Milwaukee. That's where 48-year-old Rebecca Smith lives. She voted for Trump in all three elections and likes almost everything he's done this term. She's a kindergarten teacher in a dual Spanish language program at Milwaukee Public Schools. She says she voted for Trump in 2024 because she wanted more secure borders.
Once these people enter in illegally, then what else are they doing? Where are they going to?
Smith's husband is an immigrant from Costa Rica. He's now a U.S. citizen. She says he had to wait to come here lawfully and went through a vetting process, answering questions like if he had ever committed a crime or was arrested.
Look at the documents that we put people through to become a citizen in this country. Look at what they're expected to prove that they have not done, that they do not have a background like this and that that's negative.
Like Smith, 87% of Republicans approve of how the president is handling immigration, according to the latest NPR, PBS News, Marist poll. That compares to a 44% approval among voters overall. He's overhauled U.S. immigration policy through executive orders, lawsuits, and an aggressive series of raids, detentions, and deportations. Smith says she realizes those detentions and deportations upend people's lives.
You could say it seems really cruel, but at the same time, wasn't it really cruel when we had an open border and just let all these people in?
She thinks there needs to be legislative action to make the legal process for immigration more efficient, so that people might have real hopes of being here lawfully. Smith also mostly approves of Trump's economic policy and applauds Elon Musk's DOGE effort to slice federal spending. But as a public school teacher, she's worried about programs like Head Start, which has seen funding disruptions under Trump. The program helps low-income kids learn to read and prepare for kindergarten.
Kids need to have better outcomes in school if we're thinking that they're going to become our population of good citizens and of workers.
It's possible the White House may try to eliminate funding for the program altogether, but she's hoping they won't. And she has faith in the overall mission of Trump's presidency. For NPR News, I'm Ayan Silver in Milwaukee.
Every year, venomous snake bites kill tens of thousands of people globally, and they permanently disable several hundred thousands more. Now, a team says it has developed an anti-venom cocktail that works against a diverse collection of venomous snakes, using a process that it hopes could lead to a universal anti-venom. Here's NPR's Ari Daniel.
Most people try to avoid venomous snakes. Not Tim Frady.
My claim to fame is getting bit by snakes. Think a bee sting times 1,000.
Frady has been fascinated with snakes since forever. He used to hunt garter snakes growing up in Wisconsin. As an adult, his obsession turned to venomous snakes and the harm they cause people globally. He felt the most dramatic way to raise awareness of the issue was to allow himself to be bitten. Right out of the gate, though,
I was put in ICU after 2 cobra bites, and I dropped in a coma for 4 days.
He recovered and got more careful. Freedy estimates he's now been bitten some 200 times. His motivation evolved to see if he could develop immunity to this swirl of toxins so that his body might provide a roadmap to making a broader kind of antivenom. For decades, antivenoms have come from the antibodies generated by animals like horses injected with venoms. But Jacob Glanville, the CEO of the biotech company Centivax, he wanted to find a shared molecular site across multiple venom toxins from different snake species that he could target. And rather than using a horse, Glanville figured that a person who'd been repeatedly exposed to lots of different venoms might have antibodies directed against such a site.
I was calling vivariums, hoping for a clumsy snake researcher.
And then he found Tim Fritty.
He goes, "You're the guy I'm looking for. We need your blood. We need your antibodies."
If anybody has broken through the problem of getting the immune system to focus, it's this guy by this repeated stimulation with all these snakes.
I'm like, wow, cool. Great.
So Glanville scanned Fritty's blood, poring over the troves of antibodies to find those that bound the neurotoxins of multiple snakes.
And we found the ultra-broad antibody that had this very remarkable ability to go bind right on the conserved site that the neurotoxin uses to cause paralysis.
In mice, the antibody worked fully against 5 snakes, the black mamba and a mix of cobras. Next, Glanville and his colleagues added a small molecule that had already been shown to work against some venoms, and they went back to Fritty's blood and found a second broad-acting antibody.
And that's when we suddenly saw this coherent protection that was happening across this large panel.
This cocktail of 3 components offered mice complete protection against 13 species and partial protection against 6 more, representing venomous snakes from Asia, Africa, Australia, North America, and more. There are other antivenoms that can neutralize a diverse set of snakes, but this is the first to do so using synthetic antibodies. The results are published in the journal Cell. David Williams is a scientist who evaluates antivenoms for the World Health Organization who wasn't involved in the research.
It's definitely a step in the right direction because it's answering some of the questions we have about how to properly design universal antibodies.
Williams cautions that further developing this cocktail into a truly universal antivenom will inevitably have its challenges, including doing human trials and expanding its coverage to vipers, which make up about 1/2 of venomous snakes. Meanwhile, when Tim Fritty heard that his antibodies had helped create this new antivenom cocktail, he says he was happy.
When I do it, I know I'm doing something for humanity and getting back to science.
Fritty is now director of herpetology at Centivax, where the team is planning to test their new cocktail in dogs that have been bit by venomous snakes in Australia. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth announced this week that he wants to get rid of a program designed to promote the contributions and safety of women in global conflict zones. The Women, Peace, and Security Program was signed into law by President Trump in 2017 and co-sponsored by two members of Trump's current cabinet. It also passed with bipartisan support. In a post on X, Hegseth initially called the program a woke Biden-era initiative. He later clarified those comments, saying that its original mission became distorted under the Biden administration. So, why does Hegseth now want to eliminate the program? And what might be the implications if it goes away? Kathleen McInnes is a senior fellow in the Defense and Security Department at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She's been a staunch defender of the program and its impact on women in the military. My colleague Juana Summers spoke with her this week.
I just want to understand on a practical level what this might have looked like across the U.S. military services. I wonder if you can give us a couple of examples as to how the goals of women, peace, and security were implemented.
Sure. It's things like making sure that body armor can fit women's service members. Now, it seems like a very simple thing that, you know, when you are sending your forces forward, you want to make sure that they have the best equipment that they can possibly have so they can fight and win our wars. When you put men's body armor on a woman's body, there's actually spaces where shrapnel can hit women's sides. And so getting those kinds of considerations into the overall Department of Defense system, that was one of the tasks that the Women, Peace, and Security agenda was trying to accomplish, making sure that our women warfighters were capable of fighting and winning wars.
I'll note here that though Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says he is moving away from this program, this initiative is something that's enshrined into law. The Defense Secretary does not have the ability to either rewrite laws or to overturn them. But what does it mean that he is now signaling that a move away by the Defense Department, a lack of investment, a lack of agreement with this policy?
What he is signaling he's intending to do is take what is required by law and do essentially only the bare minimum consistent with statute and make sure that the executive branch is compliant. So there's a bunch of things that have been happening under the Women, Peace, and Security agenda that have been improving the operational effectiveness of the force, but weren't necessarily matched against the Women, Peace, and Security Act of 2017 itself. My understanding is that he's also asking for legislative relief down the line to argue that the Department of Defense should no longer implement the Women, Peace, and Security Act at all.
A number of Republicans have vocally championed the Women, Peace, and Security Initiative as an example of President Trump's successes, particularly when it comes to women's issues. Here is Secretary of State Marco Rubio speaking at the International Women of Courage Award Ceremony. This was just last month.
President Trump also signed the Women, Peace, and Security Act, a bill that I was very proud to have been a co-sponsor of when I was in the Senate. And it was the first comprehensive law passed in any country in the world, first law passed by any country anywhere in the world, focused on protecting women and promoting their participation in society.
Kathleen McInnes, what's changed?
There's concerns that the agenda has been implemented in a manner that is consistent with what people would call a DEI or woke agenda, that it has overly tokenized women in the armed forces. It's created burdensome training requirements, and it's just been kind of a pain in implementation and therefore degrading the effectiveness of the military. 17.7% of active duty troops right now are women, and 21.9% of reserve service members are women. So that's about 20% of the military force that need things like body armor and access to reproductive health systems, making sure that the Pentagon thinks through the unique requirements of their women service members, which are increasingly a part of the force.
Big picture, we have heard Defense Secretary Hegseth say that he wants women to have diminished roles in combat. And I know that you follow this area closely. His tenure is still in the early days, but what are you thinking as it gets started?
I don't understand the rhetoric because I don't understand how it comports with war. When we've thought about Iraq and Afghanistan, when you look at Ukraine, the distinction between combat and non-combat is very blurry. It's very porous. The very character of war is changing. So there's strategic advantage that you can build into your force by integrating women effectively.
That's Kathleen McInnes from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Over 5 days in the middle of April, Los Angeles police say a man named Samuel Patrick Groft chopped down about a dozen city trees with an electric chainsaw. He was arrested on April 22nd, Earth Day. Groft has since been charged with felony vandalism. NPR's Vanessa Romo has more.
Medea Musavi was on a morning walk when he came across about a half a dozen fallen shade trees in downtown Los Angeles, where he lives. At first, he thought that the city had cut them down. But as word spread of possible vandalism, he said he was livid.
Who did this? It was an act of destruction.
He immediately posted about it on his Instagram account. The posts went viral. Tens of thousands of angry comments poured in from users who were equally perplexed and dismayed over the loss of any amount of the city's meager urban tree canopy.
I think that the uproar from everybody that we heard and we saw online definitely shows how people feel when it comes to nature.
In posts, people called for justice and revenge. They demanded that the culprit be forced to replant new trees.
You can replace graffiti, you can replace broken glass. Trees that take that much time to grow and honestly do nothing but provide us with a benefit, what did a tree ever do to anybody?
The LAPD says Groft sometimes hacked away at large 10 to 50-year-old trees in the middle of the night. In other cases, he wielded his cordless chainsaw on busy sidewalks in broad daylight. It's unclear if Groft is still being detained. NPR reached out to LA's public defender's office but did not receive a response. The bizarre act of vandalism has incensed locals who say they're already fed up with the problems that seem to have taken over downtown since the COVID-19 pandemic. Businesses and restaurants have shuttered and offices have cleared out. There's been a spread of homeless encampments, and residents say there's rampant open drug use. Leslie Ridings says he's completely demoralized by this bout of destruction. As co-founder of the Downtown LA Residents Association, he's actively trying to build a thriving community.
Part of downtown's job is to be a gathering place. We come here to celebrate. We gather here to mourn, like we are the heart of the city. And that's awesome. And we want more density, more residents. We want all of it.
But a crime like this, which he describes as wanton destruction for destruction's sake, gives the public the impression that antisocial behavior will be overlooked.
It really highlights the presumption of impunity.
The public outrage has been so fervent that Mayor Karen Bass has also weighed in, calling the attacks beyond comprehension. She's promised residents that all of the trees would be quickly replaced, an expense police say will be more than $350,000. No small feat in a city that's facing a billion-dollar budget shortfall. Vanessa Romo, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Femi Kuti, son of Afrobeat pioneer Fela Kuti, is a musician whose lyrics are mostly political. But on his latest album, inspired by his daughter, he wanted to write something more personal.
I thought it was important that I talked about things that have guided me through my life.
I'm Don Gagne. We hear Kuti's life lessons through his music on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, we tackle the great internet debate. Who would win in a fight, 100 men or one gorilla?
A gorilla is an enormous, extremely powerful animal, and we are puny humans.
Many strong opinions ahead after today's news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The Trump administration and Secretary of Health are vowing to crack down on toxic chemicals, but as NPR's Will Stone reports, stiff job cuts by the administration have demolished an agency devoted to investigating these hazards.
Studies on workplace exposure to chemicals that may harm reproductive health. Investigations into a possible cancer cluster at a state university. The only national program tracking blood lead levels in adults. These are among the many casualties of the Trump administration's firing of about 90% of the staff at the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH. Dr. Robert Harrison at UCSF says NIOSH is instrumental in funding and advancing research on carcinogens and other dangerous substances.
It's been near eliminated. It's almost destroyed.
In a statement to NPR, the Department of Health and Human Services said critical initiatives under NIOSH will remain intact and will join the newly created Administration for a Healthy America. Will Stone, NPR News.
Well, Canada's newly elected prime minister will travel to Washington on Tuesday for a meeting with President Trump. Dan Karpinchuk has more on that.
The meeting will come even before Carney names his new cabinet in the wake of Monday's federal election in Canada. At the top of the agenda will be Trump's trade war with Canada. Tuesday's talks could set the groundwork for negotiations over a new trade and security pact. Speaking to reporters in Ottawa, Carney would not say anything about his approach to the meeting, adding that he doesn't want to negotiate in public. He says he expects difficult but constructive talks and will act in the best interests of Canada. Carney also said when he and Trump talked earlier this week, there was no mention of annexing Canada. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
The Kentucky Derby could be a mudder's delight with rain in the forecast. Officials say the racetrack at Churchill Downs could turn into something resembling peanut butter tomorrow if the forecast is correct. This is NPR. One of the most popular dishes out of Rome is notoriously hard to cook, but as NPR's Emily Kwong tells us, scientists have written up a foolproof recipe.
The dish at the center of this research is cacio e pepe. You know what I'm talking about. It's the one that's a symphonic combination of pasta, black pepper, and pecorino romano cheese. Now, when cooking, heat can cause the proteins in the cheese to clump together. So for generations, home cooks have added cornstarch or potato starch to the water first.
In Italian kitchens, grandma had somehow, you know, always a scientific attitude, right? So they were doing scientific methods.
Giacomo Bartolucci and his team sought to formalize what he calls grandma knowledge through science. In the journal Physics of Fluids, they report that the ideal ratio of cheese to starch is 2.5%. So all you need to know is that before adding 160 grams of pecorino cheese, first dissolve 4 grams of starch into your pasta water. Emily Kwong, NPR News.
All right, pack your patience. That's the advice of travel experts if you're planning to fly out of a U.S. airport in the coming weeks. Starting May 7th, most adults will not be allowed to fly without a real ID. That or a passport will be required even for domestic flights. If you're not sure whether your driver's license qualifies, look for that real ID star. Most states put it in the top right corner of that license. Stocks finished higher to end the week on Wall Street. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. As President Trump pursues his trade war, jobs on the home front are holding up fairly well. The Labor Department delivered a better-than-expected jobs report this morning. That's despite the stiff new tariffs that took effect at the beginning of last month. NPR's Scott Horsley is here to tell us more. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Sasha.
Give us the big overview. What's the main thing we should know about today's report?
The main message of this report is that despite rattling the stock market and putting a big dent in consumer confidence, the trade war has so far not done much damage to the U.S. job market. Employers added 177,000 jobs last month. That's down only slightly from the pace of hiring in March. Forecasters were expecting a bigger drop, just given all the uncertainty that the trade war has caused for businesses and investors and ordinary people. Economist Michael Puglisi of Wells Fargo says today's report suggests the job market is still in pretty solid shape, at least for now.
It was a pretty strong report. You know, across the board, I think it showed another pretty solid month for the labor market.
So far, the unemployment rate is also holding steady at a low 4.2%. And we saw a lot of new people joining or rejoining the workforce last month. So that's also encouraging.
Scott, what kinds of sectors are all these new jobs coming from?
Some of the jobs are coming in industries that are pretty well insulated from the ups and downs of the economy, like healthcare. That saw the biggest job gains last month. And, you know, hospitals are generally pretty recession-proof. But restaurants and bars are not recession-proof, and they also added about 17,000 jobs in April. That was not a given, especially after we got some worrisome reports this week about a drop in U.S. sales at restaurants like McDonald's and Domino's Pizza. There are some weak spots in today's jobs report, though. Manufacturing, for example, lost about 1,000 jobs in April. The president's trade war is supposed to help domestic manufacturers, but another report we got this week showed factories are really struggling with these tariffs. They're driving up the cost of imported components and raw materials, and they're driving away customers in foreign markets. Automakers in particular lost close to 5,000 jobs in April, and General Motors says it expects a multi-billion dollar tariff bill this year.
What about all the federal government jobs that have been lost due to Elon Musk and his Doge team cutting them? What does the report say about that?
Yeah, according to the official headcount, the federal government has lost about 26,000 jobs since the beginning of the year. 9,000 of those cuts came last month. We expect a lot more cuts in the federal government if the administration follows through with all the plans that have been announced. Some of those federal cuts are being offset, though, by government hiring at the state and local level. So in April, for example, we actually saw a net gain in government jobs overall.
Any sense of a forecast for the job market overall in months to come?
I think that's still a big question mark. You know, it was just exactly a month ago that the president announced his worldwide tariffs. And since then, there have been a lot of ups and downs and some backtracking. So who knows what the trade picture is going to look like in another month or two or three. The latest consumer confidence survey, which came out earlier this week, showed people are not at all confident about job prospects in the months to come. They're worried about layoffs and rising unemployment. But Wells Fargo's Puglisi says today's number shows that, for now at least, the job market has not gone over a cliff.
It suggests that, at least into the spring, we were on a pretty solid footing. And you know, how much momentum we do or do not lose in the coming months is up for debate.
The stock market rallied on the jobs news. The Dow jumped more than 560 points. It is still down, though, from where it was a month ago when Trump launched his trade war.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, it seems like every week there is a new main character, someone or something that the internet is obsessed with. And I'm going to be really honest here. Most of the time, these main characters, whatever we call them, they reach me like a month later. So thank God for people like All Things Considered producer Mia Venkat, who is chronically obsessed with what the internet is obsessed with. So she helps me fake being cool. Hey, Mia, I'm so grateful to you.
You're welcome, Elsa.
All right, so tell us, what was the internet so obsessed with this week?
Okay, so this week, it's the one gorilla versus 100 men debate. And I'd be shocked if you haven't seen this one yet.
Well, the only reason I have seen this by now is because I saw you talking about it on the All Things Considered Slack channel we have.
Right.
And I was like, what is happening? Like, I've never seen so many of our producers have so many strong opinions so fast about anything. Why are people so fired up about this?
I don't know why people are so fired up about this, but it became a thing when someone posted a version of this question on X, and people really just ran with it, and the internet has been debating it all week.
100 people could not defeat one gorilla because of the logistics. Like,
he's severely outnumbered. Hello?
A lot of y'all is really taking into account, like, King Kong and...
These men be losing fights in real life versus people. Talk about me versus a gorilla.
Some TikTok clips from Delamo Manny, Flossy Baby, Last Ways, and the Mogul Juniors. And you can hear in their
Thank
voices
God
also.
You've identified them, because now I know exactly who they are.
Exactly. But people are clearly really passionate about this.
Okay, you know what I think the answer is? I would totally have the gorilla winning, because if you get 100 men doing anything, they're going to argue about who is in charge, and nothing is going to happen.
It also requires them to, like, have a strategy and coordinate, which I don't see happening.
Nope.
And also, it feels to me like it just seems like a way for 100 men to just hang out and have a shared goal. I feel like maybe just, I don't know, pick up a hobby. But anyways, actually, most of our team agrees with you. I polled All Things Considered staffers, and almost 70% of them said the gorilla would win.
Woohoo!
And when I was in the newsroom, I bumped into Ollie Dearden, who is a deputy managing editor at NPR. He was very passionately Team Gorilla, and I'm going to be honest, I had to cut most of his answer because he had very graphic descriptions of what the gorilla would do to the humans, but here's part of what he said.
We are puny humans. You've also got to remember, these men will not coordinate. They'll go in as individuals, making it easier for the gorilla to rip their limbs
off. Thinking the men are kind of single file line, just going, you
It's
know.
Not SEAL Team 6, is it?
I love how you're trying to have this reason back and forth with Ollie. Okay, wait. So is there an answer to this question? Like an actual scientific, empirically based
right.
answer?
Well, Elsa, I am a journalist, so I have to find out. I have to call up a primatologist.
Wait. Like, how did you explain the reason for this call?
It was not easy. I was like, I'm so sorry. I know this is silly. I have to do this for work. And people really want to know, like, the whole internet is obsessed with this. Like, what is the answer? So Tara Suwinski has been studying gorillas for over 30 years. She's the CEO and chief scientific officer of the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund. And she actually told me that they've seen increased traffic on their website this week, especially on the gorilla anatomy page, which is so funny. She, like, knows that this is a very silly subject and a ridiculous hypothetical, but she hopes that all this gorilla talk leads people to think about the actual fight gorillas are in right now, which is for their survival, because they're critically endangered.
Right.
And it was interesting to me because she told me their nicknames are the gentle giants. They're way more gentle than media might make them seem. All that said, I know what people want to hear is what her take on the situation was. So, Stuwinski says, to answer this, you have to think about what each side brings to the fight.
Male gorillas are the largest primate on the planet. They weigh 400 pounds. They have incredible upper body strength, really strong jaw muscles. So they bring a lot to a fight. But I think just the sheer numbers that the humans have would mean that the gorilla would probably eventually be overpowered.
I mean, she had me at strong jaw muscles there.
I know that she said the gorilla would lose, but she made it clear to me that 100 men are not leaving that fight.
That is clear. That was our producer, Mia Venkat. Thank you so much, Mia.
You're welcome, Elsa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. At San Antonio's traditional spring celebration called Fiesta, one of the highlights is the Ford Mariachi Festival. Since it's now spring, it's time for that festival, and we wanted to hear some of it. So Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan takes us to the Riverwalk.
San Antonio's downtown is built on two levels. One features the bustling city streets, and then 15 feet down is the river level, where barges tote tourists and the circular mile-and-a-half horseshoe bend filled with hotels and restaurants. Earlier this week, I descended to the river where several dozen high schoolers milled about, holding and sometimes playing guitars, violins, guitarrons, and trumpets. A cloud with heavy rain threatened to let loose.
My name is Jason Thibodeau. I'm the director of orchestras from Churchill High School,
and I also conduct the Mariachi Orgullo from Churchill High School.
Thibodeau says the Mariachi Club was his student's idea. He notes that taking on mariachi was family tradition for some, but not all.
For some of our kids, this is how they relate to their past or their own traditions. And then for some of our kids, like me, they're learning a new tradition.
Orchestra and choir programs there are musical electives, and mariachi is a music club for after-school hours. Carlos Cifuentes plays the five-string vihuela.
We like to explain it to people as a bigger ukulele or as a guitar without the top E string.
This isn't family tradition for Carlos. It's one that immerses him in a past he's never had.
As a proud first-generation Hispanic teenager, joining the Mariachi Orgullo was definitely one of the best decisions I could have done in my high school years.
River barges appear, and one mariachi band after another loaded students on and began the performance route to crowds lining the Horseshoe Bend. Azul Ruiz has been playing since fifth grade, and she is carrying on family tradition.
I'm actually from Mexico City, and my grandfather was a composer, and my father sung in mariachis.
The impression that Mariachi Club has made on Azul has her making plans, and she credits Thibodeau with part of it.
I'm going to study art education. I want to be an art teacher. Kind of based on what Mr. T is like, he puts all his dedication into this, like a fine art.
Sarah Moore plays violin.
I started orchestra when I was in sixth grade and have continued that all throughout high school. And then I joined the mariachi program at Churchill my sophomore year.
Sarah hadn't played this music growing up, but she says her curious nature led her to join the Mariachi Club.
Honestly, it was just my interest in music itself and wanting to immerse myself in a new culture.
We loaded up and headed to the Horseshoe Bend where the kids got to play, and at one stop, were joined by ballet for political dancers. Maria Tijerina was one of a large crowd of visitors who watched the kids play and dance.
And I think that's a great way to help them succeed, not just in their high school, but also in their community, with their families, and in their future too.
The rain cloud moved on, leaving the kids to the warm embrace of the thousands lining the river. On the Riverwalk, I'm Jack Morgan for NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. During his first 100 days in office, President Trump has taken steps to crack down on immigration and end diversity programs in higher education and the federal government. Those actions came on the heels of an election in which Trump expanded his support among non-white voters, including some groups directly affected by these policies. NPR's Sarah McCammon has been exploring how Trump grew his base. She recently traveled to Nevada to find out how his policies are being received so far. It's a state where Asian American voters play a growing role.
Pauline Lee is the daughter of immigrants who came to the United States as teenagers and started out with nothing.
So when they came here, they were dirt poor, and my dad worked at a Chinese laundry for his uncle and his dad.
She says her parents both went on to study and build successful careers in California. Lee is proud of her family's immigration stories and the fact that they came to the U.S. legally.
Illegal immigration is, for me, one of the biggest problems, because you're also giving these illegal immigrants a lot of our resources that should be retained for our own Americans.
Lee, a retired attorney, is active in Republican politics in Nevada. About 6 in 10 Asian Americans in the state voted for President Trump over Democratic nominee Kamala Harris in November. That's a huge swing from 4 years earlier, when a little more than 6 in 10 Asian voters backed Joe Biden. Over lunch, Lee says many of her Asian American friends also appreciate Trump's rejection of diversity initiatives known as DEI.
I'm going to say right now, I'm resentful as a parent that my kids have to do more than other kids to get into certain colleges.
When her now adult children were applying to college, she says counselors steered them away from the Ivy League, warning they'd be up against too many other top performing Asian students. Las Vegas City Councilwoman Frances Allen Polinsky has heard similar frustrations.
I think most Asian people feel as though when colleges go through this vetting process that the ethnicity of the students should not be released, so that there is absolute parity in that discussion, you know, true meritocracy, if there is such a thing.
Allen Polinsky, whose mother came to the U.S. from South Korea, previously served as a Republican state lawmaker. She says the shift toward Republicans among Asian Americans in Nevada is about other issues, too.
Gas prices, inflation, the ability to buy a home, particularly here in Southern Nevada, has changed over the last 15 years.
The shift likely has a lot to do with Trump's promises on the economy, says James Zarza-Diaz, a historian at the University of San Francisco.
There's a strong working class and lower middle class community of Asian Americans in Nevada, many of them working in hospitality in the gaming industry. And so I think they're feeling the pinch more, right, at the grocery store, at the gas pump.
When it comes to Trump's economic policies, Rachel Puena, a local teacher whose husband and four adult children are union workers, says she sees Trump standing up for the United States.
Is this what you voted for? Yes, that's what we voted for. The tariffs, I've been wanting to do that for over 20 years. I looked at the stock market. Yep, it's plummeting. And I was like, well, this is what we get for allowing them to do this to us for how many years?
Puena, whose parents immigrated to the U.S. from the Philippines, also supports Trump's immigration policies. Historian James Zarza-Diaz says for some Asian Americans with these recent ties to immigration, those very experiences have drawn them to Trump's rhetoric.
They'll say, well, like, that's not fair. I had to wait, you know, 7-10 years to get to America, and then they're granted amnesty, and so they feel insulted. And so they don't see immigration as a racial issue. They see it as a fairness issue or a matter of law and order.
But for some Asian Americans here, uncertainty around Trump's deportation policy is causing fear. At an Asian cultural festival in Las Vegas, I met May, a naturalized citizen who was born in the Philippines. She says Trump's talk of rethinking birthright citizenship worries her.
Oh, I'm just worried. I'm like, will I be next? Kind of like, you know what I mean?
May asked us not to use her last name. She has a family member who's seeking citizenship, and she's hesitant to speak publicly.
And I'm just worried that, like, for him, just because he's going through the right channels, he could be deported, and it's just, like, a little bit uneasiness.
Nevada represents a more pronounced example of a larger shift. Asian American voters nationwide moved toward Trump by about 6 points last year compared to 2020. That said, it's unclear whether Trump can maintain that support. A lot will likely depend on how his policies continue to play out in the days and years to come. Sarah McCammon, NPR News, Las Vegas.
In Rio, in Brazil, Lady Gaga will soon be hosting the biggest concert of her career. More than 1.5 million people are expected to be in the audience on Copacabana Beach on Saturday. And fans have been flocking there to watch the preparations, as Julia Carneo reports.
Lady Gaga will be touring the world later this year to promote her latest album, Mayhem. But only here in Rio can the concert be called Mayhem on the Beach. Crowds are gathered here to watch the huge stage that's being set up on the sand as a cool breeze blows from the sea. Tali Schmidt is part of her fan base, Little Monsters, as they call themselves.
We all performing Abracadabra by Lady Gaga, the new song that took us crazy.
What does it mean for you, for Lady Gaga to be in Rio?
It means a lot. She has been with me for all my life, since I was a little kid, a gay kid. Since she taught me a lot about loving myself, accepting myself.
Juan Silva is from Rio and has been waiting to see Lady Gaga live. Since 2017, he had bought a ticket for the show she was due to perform in Rio back then, but she canceled it for health reasons. And now he's here anxiously waiting in front of the stage being set up.
I'm so excited. I'm so excited for this show. It's my dream. It's all my love.
Outside the iconic Copacabana Palace Hotel, it already feels like a crowded pop concert. Her fans are gathered here hoping to get any glimpse of Lady Gaga. Over the past day, she's had batches of pizza delivered to the crowds outside the hotel. Has she appeared at all?
No, it's been 2 days, but she sent pizza.
Nicole Lima traveled all the way from the Northeast to be here. She got on a plane and then on a bus just for the concert.
I'm going to arrive here at 5 a.m. to wait for her. I really want to see her, not from the screen. I want to see her with my own eyes.
Check 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Rio residents are starting to get used to mega concerts like this. Last year, Madonna held her biggest ever show on Copacabana Beach. The City Hall's bet is that this will help boost the economy and the city's image abroad. For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro on Copacabana Beach.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at Lodestar Foundation.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.